nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so to continue our discussion of this model that we have been talking about for the last two lectures, where this current through a device can be written in this form, that you can think of it as different channels in energy that carry electrons from one side to the other, and the net flow from left to right depends on the difference in the Fermi functions in the two contacts. The idea being that when you apply a voltage across this, you have these two contacts whose chemical potentials are separated by the amount of the applied voltage. So this is Q times the applied voltage. And as a result, you have got two different Fermi functions. So as you know, we have talked about this, that the Fermi function looks something like this. It changes from 1 to 0 right around the chemical potential. This function tells you whether states are occupied or not. And way below the chemical potential, they are all fully occupied. So it's 1. Way above, it's 0. So, and around the chemical potential, over an energy range of the order of kT, it changes from 1 to 0. So that's this Fermi function in the left contact. And if you draw it for the right contact, it would look similar, except that now the change appears around mu 2. And the model that we are talking about, the essence of it is that current flows because this contact tries to fill up these states, that contact tries to empty them. And so the current is proportional to the difference between F1 and F2. And how much current you get then depends on F1 minus F2. But then there is this factor here, which we discussed last day, that depending on the regime of transport we are talking about, you can get different expressions. And the simplest case is when you have like molecular transport, this is really small. In that case, this function is just the density of states times the rate at which things come in and out. And then we went on to this ballistic transport case, in which case you can think of it as if you have two channels. You know, you have this density of states inside the material. That, of course, is always fundamental. Anytime you want to understand current flow, first thing you ask for is what's the density of states and where's the chemical potential? That's like zero. First question one should ask. Okay. Now, this density of states, you can divide up into two groups. And that's what I said was kind of like having a northbound lane and a southbound lane. One that carries current from left to right, the other that carries current from right to left. And you have like half the states, the total density of states, you can divide it up. You've got half of them here and half of them here. And this half that goes from left to right is filled up according to the Fermi function on the left-hand side. And that is true as long as you have ballistic transport. That is, anyone going right doesn't change their mind and start going left. As long as that doesn't happen, the occupation of this lane depends on this end of things. And the occupation of this lane depends on this end of things. That's the simplest picture for this ballistic transport case. That your density of states has two halves, one of which is filled up from F1, and the other is filled up from F2. And from that picture, you could write down the current, as we discussed, that, as you know, current is like Q times electron density times the velocity. And so the electron density is D over 2 times F1. You know, this is the density of states available. F tells you whether the state is occupied or not. So when you multiply it, you get the electron density. That's Q. You multiply it by Q. Actually, we need the electron density per unit length. I have defined density of states as just being per unit energy for the whole thing. So if you want it per unit length, you have to divide it by L. And then you have to multiply it by the velocity. So that would then tell you how much current is running from left to right. Q and V. And that then is what would enter this transmission here. So for reasons that are not completely clear, that's not obvious here, is we prefer to write it as Q over H times this. What you might think is, why isn't the H part of that? Why am I pulling out a H? Yeah? That isn't completely obvious. But algebraically, of course, you could always do that. And you can see that the expression for T should be, you know, there's a Q, there's the F1, and so you have D over 2L Vx. That's what you'd expect for that, except that since I've pulled out this H for no good reason, I need to add a H here. So that's really the expression for T in the ballistic case, right? And this is what's often called the number of modes. This was defined as the number of modes. So let me just write that. I guess I could write it right here. So for ballistic transport then, so let me define this M of E. It's equal to, as you know, H is 2 pi H bar. So I can cancel the 2 and write this as pi D H bar Vx over L. So it's exactly the same thing, just that H is 2 pi times H bar. So just write it. So that's this M. And for ballistic transport, we could write it as I equals Q over H integral dE M of E times this F1 minus F2. Now, what we want to talk about today is this diffusive transport, this regime of diffusive transport. This is ballistic transport. And diffusive transport basically means that when electrons come in here, it's like they can change their mind and start going backwards in here because they hit all kinds of obstacles, scatterers, and that turns them around. A certain fraction of them turn around. And the question is, how would this expression be modified? Okay? And what I'd said earlier last day, and that's what we'll go through a little more, is that in general, of course, I could still define something called F plus, which tells me the occupation of states up here, somewhere here. Of course, if I go to the left, it will be F1, but then because people change their mind and turn around, it won't remain F1. It will be something else as I go along. But at any point, I could define an F plus. And at any point, again, I could define a F minus, which tells me how many are going this way. And the current can still be given by the same expression, except that this is not F1 minus F2, it's F plus minus F minus. And this you might say, well, it depends on where I stand. But then when you have steady state transport, you kind of know physically that current has to be the same everywhere. You know, if you have 10 electrons per second coming in here and only 8 electrons per second getting out, then in between, of course, the electron density will keep increasing with time. So once you have steady state, that can't happen. Whatever rate electrons or cars or whatever it is comes in from here, they have to leave from the other end. That's what you call the continuity equation. So although F plus and F minus individually change with x, the difference stays the same. I mean, if you have done the physics right and calculated right, you should get the same number independent of x, right? And that's what we'll be doing. So these are functions of x, but the difference is not. And that's what gives you the net current. And what I stated last day, and that's what I'll be going through and deriving today, is that what I can show is the following, and that is that this F plus minus F minus is actually equal to f1 minus f2, which is like the values at the two ends, f1 here and f2 there, times the mean free path, which I'll write as a lambda, the mean free path, divided by mean free path plus the length. So this I had stated last day. And what we'll do now is talk about where this comes from, the physical picture here. And as you can see, if the length is very short, that's when you get to ballistic transport. That's when the lambdas just cancel out, because you can drop the L in the denominator, makes no difference, it's very small. And then this is just F1 minus F2, and we get back what we had. On the other hand, as you make it longer and longer, this factor is what cuts down the current. And when L is like hundreds of mean free paths, you can drop the mean free path in the denominator, and that's how you get Ohm's law, that the current goes down with length for the same voltage. And so you have, I guess, the resistance, the conductance goes down with length, the resistance goes up, etc. Okay. So that's for the introduction of where we stand relative to last day. Now what I want to do is explain how one gets this. Okay. Now the way this works is that let's say we are talking about this lane that carries current from left to right. And let's say somewhere around here, there is an obstacle where a fraction of this current turns around. Okay? So the current that's flowing is M times F plus. You know, actually, we don't really need to carry the M around any more than we need to carry the Q over H around either. We could just talk in terms of F plus, actually. In fact, let me do that. Just drop the M. Those are all constants. It just multiplies the overall thing. But let's say there's this current F plus coming along, and it hits some obstacle whereby a fraction of it turns around and the rest carries on. So what carries on is, let's say, the transmission through this barrier. We'll call that T. And that's a number less than 1. That's just a fraction. So T times F plus, that's what carries on. And what goes back is R times F plus. And of course, T plus R is equal to 1, as you realize. So R is equal to 1 minus T. Let me write T is equal to 1 minus R. That we understand. Okay. Now, of course, just as there's some electrons coming from the left, there's some coming from the right, from this side. That's what I'll call, that's what's F minus. And it encounters the same obstacle. And again, basically a fraction R turns around and the fraction T goes on. So what will really go on here is R F plus plus T F minus. That's what got reflected from this and got transmitted from that. And similarly here, that's what got transmitted, and then a fraction from here gets reflected. So I could write it like this. So that's what would happen. If you have a F plus coming in, F minus coming in, what will go out of here is something like that. Okay. Now what I want to write down is how much the F plus changed from left to right of this barrier. So wherever this was. What's the difference? How much is the change here? So let's write that. So you could write delta F plus change. So you could change would be like whatever it is here minus what it is here. Okay? And this is my positive x direction. So looking here minus that. And so it's T F plus minus this. That's R F minus. So it's like T minus 1. Times F plus, plus R times F minus. And T minus 1 is actually minus R, as you realize from there. So I could combine those two things and write it as minus R times F plus minus F minus. That's it. So the change in F plus is proportional to this difference. So let me write that here. And let me try to write the delta F minus, how much the F minus changes. And here again, I should look at the value on the right and subtract from it the value on the left, because that's my reference direction for x. So from here to here, and so this F minus minus 1 minus t minus r plus. And 1 minus t is r. So again, I could write this as, you'll notice I'm actually getting exactly the same thing. It's actually minus r f plus minus f minus. I'm getting exactly the same thing. And that's not completely intuitive. You might have expected this with a negative sign, but this is something you have to think through and make sure you're convinced. It's actually exactly the same thing. And one thing I can show you is, if they weren't exactly the same thing, you wouldn't have got what I had said earlier, namely that F plus minus F minus remains the same independent of x. Because what we're saying is, no matter where you go, that difference remains the same. Now, if the difference remains the same, then of course delta F plus must be equal to delta F minus. Those two must be the same. Then of course, there won't be any delta for the whole thing, which is exactly what this says. Okay. So the equations we get then is that delta F plus is equal to delta F minus equal to that. So this is what would happen if on this highway you had one localized spot with some reflection. And in general, of course, what we are trying to describe is a situation where you have distributed reflection all over the place. So it's not like at one point 10% turn around. It's more like it's a continuous process. A fraction of it keeps turning around. And if you consider a small distance delta x, then what you'd expect is that the reflection from that small distance would be proportional to delta x. And we can write it as delta x divided by something with the dimensions of length, and that's what we'd call the mean free path. That's basically what mean free path is about. It's like, gives you the length scale of this reflection. So what I'll do is, here I'll put equal to minus delta x divided by the mean free path. That's it. Okay. Now, you'll notice here, then, we could, of course, let these things become infinitesimals, and then you'd have a differential equation, right, which is what we want. So you could write a differential equation that would look like this. Df plus dx is equal to df minus dx. Is equal to minus that's it. So F plus will change with x, F minus will change with x, and the d dx is proportional to this difference. That's what comes out of this discussion. Okay. So what we now need to do is, we need to find F plus and F minus subject to these boundary conditions. Boundary conditions meaning that when you go to the left-hand side, F plus should be equal to F1. And when I go to the right-hand side, F minus should be equal to F2. That's the overall boundary condition. So you could So that's the equation we are trying to solve. And the solution looks like So this is the F plus. And on the left-hand side, it has the value equal to F1. That's what it is here. And F minus is equal to F2 on the right-hand side. Remember, everything going to the right that got filled up from here, that was F1. It's F2 on the other side. And in between, they're both changing. And how does it change? Well, the ddx is equal to this. And one nice thing is we know that this is constant. So it's like the derivative is a constant. So what that means is the change is just linear. So basically, as you go through, it just goes linearly like this. And this also goes linearly. Like this. That's it. And they have exactly the same slope, and they track each other, so the difference is the same everywhere. So you can calculate the current anywhere you want. You could calculate it here, you could calculate it here, you could calculate it here. The current would just be this difference between F plus and F minus, and times a few constants, like the number of modes and Q over H and all that stuff. And you can calculate it anywhere, you'd get the same number, no matter where you calculate. Okay, so now what we need to do is just figure out what this value is, or what this value is. Because right now I have the problem. Sure, I can calculate F minus anywhere, but there is no point where I know both of them. You go to the left, I know this one, F1, but I have no idea what this one is. And when I get here, I know F2, but I have no idea where that one is. So I can calculate it anywhere, but then no place do I know both. So that's what we need to figure out. Now, the current, of course, is proportional to this. As I said, you could put in this m's and q over h's and all, which I'm not worrying about. So I could call that like I, that difference. That's what current is. So if this is F2, then this would be like F2 plus I. In fact, let me just put the m as a reminder that F2 is just occupation, and current is like MF2, and Q over H and all that, which I'm not worrying about. It's MF2, and this current would be MF2 plus I. Or if I looked here, this is MF1. That's the current that comes in, and this will be MF1 minus I. And that way, the difference is I, difference is I. And how do I figure out I? Well, this equation already tells me that the slope should be I over lambda. So if I look at this, it's like it's mf1 here, it's mf2 plus I over here, and it goes linearly in between over a length equal to L. So I can write the slope, and that slope should be I over lambda again, because the slope is I over lambda. So what I could do is I could say I over lambda must be equal to so you could do it more formally, you know, the way you solve differential equations, write down with an unknown constant and all that. But I'm just trying to take a bit of a shortcut here. But you can see, the basic idea is, I just said, it has to be this, and the slope should be what the differential equation told me it should be. And this is what you get. And now you see I have an equation for A, so I can just, for I, and I can just calculate the current. So I would be like M times F1 minus F2 over L. That's fine. So it's like I times 1 over lambda plus 1 over L is equal to that. So what I did is, I have an I here and an I there. I brought this over. It's equal to that. So what do we get for I? This is L. And this stuff, if I take over to that side, will give me something like this. So what I did is, you know, combine this. It's lambda L over lambda plus L. Take it over to the other side. I'm sorry, this is lambda plus L over lambda L. So when I take it over to the other side, it looks like that. And then the L cancels and you get this. Right? And remember, what I was calling I is basically M times this quantity. So in other words, if I had dropped the M, if I write this as I over M, that's really like F plus minus F minus. That's really what we've done. So point is, you know, this is what I set out to prove. I was saying that what I was going to show you is that under conditions of diffusive transport, when you're continually getting turned around along the channel, your F minus at any point, which would be constant, would be F1 minus F2. That's what you hold at the two ends times lambda over lambda plus L. That's what I kind of set out to prove. And this is how you get there. So, now, so we can write the equation for the current then based on this discussion. Like it looks, have something like this. It's got some function here times F1 minus F2. And this function then is equal to what I defined here as modes, but times this lambda over lambda plus L. That's it. So if I take this out, the point is that the transmission, what I defined as T bar here, will be this M, which involves density of stage, velocity, etc., times lambda over lambda plus L. That's it. And as I mentioned before, that this is the factor that gives you something like Ohm's law, while this M, that's like how many lanes you have on your highway. That's what depends on the cross section. And as you know, basically Ohm's law tells us that conduction, the conductivity, conductance, it is proportional to the cross sectional area divided by the length. So divided by the length part comes from here. And as you can see, it's not exactly A over L. It should really be A over L plus lambda. It's just that usually you are talking of long conductors, many, many mean free paths long. And that's when you drop the lambda. Okay. So what I want to talk a little more now about is how to relate this to the usual expression for conductivity and actually try to get an expression for mobility. Like, if you have seen the usual discussion of how you think about conductivity, it's supposed to be electron density times the mobility, right? And that's usually derived from a totally different point of view. And I want to spend a little time now getting an expression for conductivity and relating it. Okay. Now, first point is that how would we get an expression for conductance out of this? Because as you know, the usual picture, conductance is sigma A over L. So we'd like to get an expression like this. And how is conductance defined? It's current divided by voltage. That's what it is. Okay? And of course, when we do this, we won't quite get sigma A over L. What we'll end up with is sigma A over L plus lambda. That's what we'll get. So if you started from this, you would have thought that if something went, if the length became zero, the conductance should just become infinite. Resistance is zero. But what is experimentally well established is, even when you look at the smallest conductors, the conductance never really becomes infinite. For a given voltage, you get a very finite amount of current. Right? And the correct expression for that works in all limits is would be something that looks more like this. Okay. Now, but then what is sigma? And that's what we want to do next. Now, the thing is, if you look at this expression, it's got F1 minus F2 and all that, and you say, well, I want conductance, so I need the voltage, current divided by voltage, but voltage is kind of hidden in there. Where is it hidden? It's hidden in those Fermi functions. Remember, F1 and F2 Fermi functions involve this mu1 and mu2, and that's where all the voltage is. Voltage is what separates them. So what you could do is, you could say, well, let's talk about a small voltage. And in that case, F1 and F2 are nearly the same function, but just with the mu a little bit different. What I mean by that is, as you know, Fermi function looks like this. And the difference between F1 and F2 is simply that F1 has a mu1 and F2 has a mu2. But otherwise, it's exactly the same. So when you are talking about small voltages, then what we could do is write F1 minus F2 as do this Taylor series expansion idea. That is, if mu1 were equal to mu2, this would be 0. And then if mu1 is a little different from mu2, then what you get will be proportional to mu1 minus mu2. And then what you put here would be the derivative of F with respect to mu. So for small voltages, any function, you know, and when you have this you want a difference between these two points, this would be the first term in your Taylor series expansion. And because of the form of this function, you could write del f del mu as del f del e just as well, because e and mu kind of occur together in this combination. So except that it's not del f del e, it will be del f minus del f del e. So usually this is the way people write it. So if you take the Fermi function, take its derivative with respect to energy, then whatever you did got. So for example, if your Fermi function looks like this, what does del f del e look like? Well, as you can see, out here it's 0. Down here it's also 0. Somewhere around here it peaks. So that's what minus del f del e looks like. That's the function. Okay. So if we use this Taylor series expansion, then what you'll get would be I is equal to Q over H and mu1 minus mu2, that's equal to Q times the applied voltage. So I've just used this and replace this with Q times the applied voltage. That's it. So now you can write an expression for the conductance. So conductance is I divided by voltage. So I can take the voltage out of here, put it here. And what you get will be Q square over H integral dE. And then this transmission function, then minus del f del e. So this would be the expression for the conductance that you could obtain from this point of view. And this transmission then, let's put in the actual factors that appear there. It depends on density of states, velocity, etc. So let me put all that in. So instead of this, let me write down what is there, which is pi d h bar vx over L, and then there's the lambda over L plus lambda. So that's what that is. This number of modes times this factor that comes from the diffusion part discussed. So we could simplify this a little bit. In the sense, you'll notice, I'll cancel out the h. So let me put a 2 here and a 2 here. And then 2 pi h bar is h, so I can drop that. So what you get then is q square integral dE minus del f del E times d vx lambda over 2L So all I've done is just a little algebra. That is, I've canceled out this h, which I had put in the first place before to put it in the standard form. But just taking it out now, we don't really need it. Got that out. And so we now have an expression like this. Okay. So let me just write it up here. So you have an expression for the conductance. I just wrote this thing up there. That's all. Nothing much. Okay. Now, if I compare with the standard expression d equals sigma a over l, now in order to put it in this form, you know, the way this stands, there is no a in it, this area. So let me put an a here and an a there. So what is this? This is density of states divided by the volume. And the point I had made earlier is that when you go to big conductors, the density of states becomes proportional to the volume. You double something, you get twice as many states. So in that sense, usually when you are talking about big conductors, you usually don't talk of density of states per electron volt. You talk of the density of states per electron volt per cubic centimeters. Okay? So that's this quantity. That's this density of states per unit volume. Okay. And then there's this A over lambda plus L, which is just like this A over this thing. And of course, as I mentioned before, usually people don't have the lambda there. That's what you learned in high school, and that's what you kind of carry in your mind usually. But what now looks clear is that really should be there. Okay. And what's in here then is what you could call sigma. That would be the conductivity, right? So G equals sigma A over lambda plus L. And the thing is, often I see people who, you know, they're trying to interpret this some data, and it really should be sigma A over lambda plus L, but mentally they are thinking of it as, I'll put a prime here because in order to make it work, you'll need a different conductivity. And so what you measure is conductance, and then you try to deduce a conductivity. And the thing is, if you use this formula, you'll conclude that the conductivity is kind of small. Because you can see, this is the correct expression, and you're using this expression. So what you'll kind of come up with is a sigma prime that will look like sigma times L over L plus lambda. And you often hear about people complaining that, you know, we have had this conductor which has very high mobility, very good conductivity, but then when you make small devices out of it, the mobility seems to go down. Well, mobility didn't go down. You're just interpreting it with respect to that instead of that. Okay. Okay, now this then gives you an expression for the conductivity. Now, if you want to deduce an expression for mobility, as you know, mobility, the way usually you define it, this is what you see, is this equals Q n mu n. That's the mobility of electrons, let's say. That's how you usually have defined it. And what we have here is an expression for sigma. So, in fact, let me put a sigma here and take off the extra factor. So this is sigma. That is sigma. So if I want to deduce mobility, I need an expression for n, electron density. And electron density expression is, you know, close to equilibrium. If you have a small voltage, it's just an equilibrium expression, which is dE, density of states, times F. The expression for electron density is very straightforward. If you have a certain Fermi function, these states are all filled up, so you get this. And so if you actually wanted to calculate a mobility, you should take the ratio of this to this, sigma to qn. You know, mu n is equal to, and you could come up with a number, and you could come out with something. Now, what takes a little algebra to do, and that's kind of what the first homework is about. It really asks you to find this ratio and show something, and that is what you expect, what the standard result is that this is equal to q tau over m. That's the usual expression for mobility that you have seen elsewhere, I'm sure. This is the mean free time itself. Question is, how would that come out of this discussion? Now, when you look at this though, you see that it's not just a little algebra involved here, but almost a fundamental point. And that is, it looks like the electron density depends on the Fermi function, while this one depends on del F, del E. So you think that you can't quite divide this by this and get an answer that, you know, looks like it's independent of everything else. After all, F and del F, del E look very different. It's two different things. You know, one that's only around your chemical potential, something of the order of KT. Another one that's, you know, goes way down, strictly speaking, right? And this is, of course, one important fundamental point I had mentioned before, that Fermi function goes way down and you think that conduction should depend on all electrons. And that's actually physically not correct at all. I mean, as I said, insulators don't conduct not because they don't have electrons. It's because all electrons are way down. It's because around the chemical potential, there isn't any states. So it's really conduction depends on something like this, you know, which tells you that it all depends on everything around a few kT here. It really doesn't depend on things down here normally, right? So question is then, how do you take a ratio of the two things like this, one of which depends on everything down there and the other that depends only on something around the chemical potential, and actually get a number out of this? Okay? And the thing is that in order to do that, you have to sort of assume that, okay, you sure you have lots of, you can have states way down someplace there. You could have core electrons and all kinds of things. But for this discussion, we know that these things don't matter. So ignore all this. So assume that you have a density of states that goes to zero at some point, wherever that is. Okay? Ignore everything. That's based on this physical. And then what you can do is take that and actually write it as, you can write the sigma as Q squared integral dE f of E times something. Now, how do I turn an integral like that into an integral like this? And this is where you, I guess mathematically, this is this trick called the integration by parts. That is, you have seen this somewhere, I'm sure, that if you have an integral dx and f dg dx, let's say, where f and g are two functions, you can write it as integral dx g and then minus df dx. And this you can do provided, you know, when you do this, you know, there is this extra surface term that you get usually. And that extra term is this f times g at the two ends of your integral. And as long as this function is zero at both ends, you can do this. You have to, but if it's not zero, then of course it's very important to keep it. Otherwise, you'll get all kinds of non-physical results. Okay. Now, what about our integral here? Well, on the high side, of course, the Fermi function is zero, so no problem. But on the low side, the Fermi function is not zero. So the only way you can drop it, of course, is if you say the density of states part is all zero anyway. So if you make all that assumption then the thing is you can turn that integral into looking something like this with a DDE acting on all the rest of it. Okay? And then both look like integral DE density of states times something. This also looks like integral DE, you know, Fermi function times something. This is DE, Fermi function times density of states. And what you can show is that for a simple parabolic band where E versus K, you know, looks just E equals H bar square K square over 2M, so simple parabolic bands, what you get here is exactly, looks just like this. And so when you take the ratio, you indeed get a number like that. That all works out for parabolic bands. But then in general, it's not quite like that. So what I ask you to do in this first homework problem, there's kind of two problems there. One is where you assume you're just that E equals, you know, half mv squared type of simple bands. And to obtain this. And the next one is something that's more relevant to things like graphene, where E versus K actually looks linear instead of parabolic. So there is no simple relationship, and it's not immediately obvious what you'd even call mass in that case. Because it's only parabolic bands that is obvious what's mass. If you have a funny EK relation like this, it's not even clear what to call mass. And by doing this, you can come out with an expression for mobility, and you can see what the mass has to be defined as in order to make it work. So that's kind of what this first homework is about. So... Yeah, this one, after you have gone through it, you know, if there are questions, we can talk more about it. But today, just the last few minutes, then I want to point out one other thing, and that would complete this discussion. And that is that the way this expression for conductivity is obtained, you'll notice, is based on what I'd call the elastic transport model. What I mean by that is the picture we have in mind is that an electron starts from here, goes through the device, and ends up there, and does not exchange any energy at all with the surroundings. And it is only when it gets here that it loses all this extra energy. And it's only when it is here that electrons come in from here and fill this up, and that's when some energy is dissipated. Because the point is, finally, in any device, when you apply a voltage across it and a current flows, there must be some heat dissipated, I times V. And the fact is that every electron that goes from left to right, it comes in at this energy around the chemical potential here and goes out at this energy around the chemical potential there. And somewhere it must lose that much of energy, every electron. And usually in big devices, the picture we have is that that dissipation occurs continuously everywhere. That's the picture we kind of carry in our heads usually. Whereas in the small devices, a more appropriate picture actually is that it goes through almost without losing any part of that energy. And all the heating really happens at the two ends. And there's actually experimental evidence that in very small conductors, that's indeed the case. Indeed, people say that in carbon nanotubes, with the kind of voltages they put across it, if all the heating were to happen inside the nanotube, it would have burnt up. And they think the reason it doesn't burn up is that it's not the nanotube that gets heated, it's all the big contacts that get heated. And those big things, of course, can get rid of that heat so it doesn't really burn up. And so there's experimental evidence that this is indeed the picture you have in small things, see? And so this is what I'd call this elastic transport model. And this is a model that actually Rolf Landauer had proposed long, long time ago, long before it became experimentally relevant. And he had proposed it more as a conceptual tool. He said that, you see, what really complicates this whole trying to understand current flow and all that is that dynamical processes, like how electrons move, and these dissipative processes, they are all mixed up. And that's what makes it very hard to describe the whole process. So conceptually, it's nice if you separate it out. If you think of it as, you know, some contact where heating takes place and some region where it just goes through without losing any heat. And this is what has become relevant to nano devices anyway. And what I just tried to show you was from this point of view, if you calculate a conductivity, it actually gives you answers that, you know, we can apply to big devices as well, and which actually needs some more discussion because, you know, obtaining this expression, you'll notice I took this derivative, this Taylor series expansion, which kind of implies that you just have apply a small voltage. Now, you can say that, well, you know, you can use that Taylor series expansion and derivatives like this if you apply a millivolt voltage. But the fact is, when you take big conductors, you don't apply a millivolt voltage. You know, you take it, you get a resistor from Radio Shack, you can put 10 volts across it, it will be a pretty good resistor anyway. So why? How is it that I can calculate resistance from taking a derivative like this, you know, which should apply only to a millivolt, and it applies to something across which you can put 10 volts, where obviously you couldn't have done this Taylor series expansion? And the answer is that, of course, real devices are not elastic like this across that entire length of the resistor. In the actual length resistor, you can think of it, you know, when you take a 10 kilo ohm resistor that's like a millimeter long, you could break it up into little sections that are a micron long each, mentally. Conceptually, it's like little sections like this. And it's like you come in, travel for a while, lose some heat, travel for a while, lose some heat. Now, in practice, of course, those are mixed up. But conceptually, you could kind of separate it. And so from a model like this, you could apply, calculate a conductivity, which would describe that big thing pretty well. But of course, if you had tried to apply this model directly to the big thing, it would be all wrong because of that, right? So these are all subtle issues that we'll get into later. But what I tried to describe to you this week essentially is what you could call this elastic transport model, which applies very well to small devices, and also with qualifications to large devices, right? And actually, even in small devices, there are little issues that need to be discussed, which as we go along in this course, later on, we'll talk more about energy transport issues and this energy dissipation and all that. But this is the basic picture of this elastic transport. Let me stop here today and continue. Thanks.